This is Cover 2, a podcast on the Cleveland Browns.
Hit! Browns are going to win!
Mayfield, Enzone, Landry, touchdown!
With Dan Kadar and Browns beat writer Nate Ulrich of the Akron Beacon Journal and Ohio.com. With Steve Dorshuk from the Canton Repository.
It's intercepted! Picked off by Denzel Ward!
Chubb will take this all the way! 92 yards!
Ready, Browns fans. Now, Cover 2, a podcast on the Cleveland Browns.
Hey there, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. This is Dan Kadar. Nate Ulrich will be joining me here shortly. Before we get going on the podcast this week, don't forget we are brought to you by USA Today Sports Plus. It's a new look by our friends over at USA Today at sports, and it's different, it's unique. Nate actually has a really good story up on their site right now about Darius Garland, the Cavs guard, very talented player. It's a really good story about he and his father, just in time for Father's Day. So you can check that out over at USA Today Sports Plus, or you can check it out on the Beacon Journal website, beaconjournal.com/sports. With all that said, Nate, would you like to share the news off the jump with everybody, or do you want me to? How do you want to go about this announcement?
Well, I'll share my news, and then you can share your news.
Sounds good.
All right, cool. So, I've tweeted this, so a lot of people listening may have seen it, but I am no longer the Browns beat writer for the Beacon Journal and the USA Today Network. Chris Easterling is now the Browns beat writer. I think he's going to do a great job. He's hit the ground running. I've been able to work with him, get to know him, and he is definitely up for the task. I am going to be transitioning, and I've already started, more and more I'm going to be diving into my new role, which is going to be, staying in the Beacon Journal, USA Today Network sports realm. But instead of just covering the Browns, I'm going to be branching out and bouncing around to different sports. I'm still going to be helping with the Browns. I'm still going to be covering pro sports, but I'm also going to be doing a lot of, high schools, colleges, our local Northeast Ohio athlete stories, some of our really interesting people in the area who have gone on and done great things and are doing great things in the professional ranks and, Olympics, just countless opportunities to tell interesting stories about people from Northeast Ohio. So I'm going to be doing a lot of feature stories, enterprise stories, and I'm really excited about it. I think it's really what I, most passionate about and kind of what I do best. So I think I'm going to be doing, the stuff that's in my wheelhouse on a regular basis. With the Browns beat, it's really hard to do that because you're constantly on call for news. The NFL news cycle never stops. It's 24/7, 365. So you're covering the team. You're trying to stay on top of all the updates. You're trying to, write analysis. Dan, I think we've been doing this podcast. We were talking before you hit record. We don't know the exact date because our archives are a little messed up, but due to some technical issues. But I'm thinking 7 or 8 years we've been doing this almost on a weekly basis. So there's a lot that goes into the Browns beat, and I would try to write, good, interesting stories about players and, different things going on with the team, coaches, GMs, but just the way the beat is structured and the demands of the beat, that it's hard to get to those stories as often as I'd like to. So I'm going to be able to do that more often. And I actually had a pretty sweet start to the new gig. I got to thank the bosses for letting me pursue a story that I've really wanted to do for a while now. Never had an opportunity to do it while on the Browns beat, but you know, you mentioned at the top, Dan, like, you know, Darius Garland's an all-star point guard for the Cavs. He's from Gary, Indiana. He is the son of an NBA, former NBA player, Winston Garland, who's a Gary legend. And my kind of professional journalism career post-college started in Northwest Indiana. I worked for a newspaper out there about 15 years ago, and I got to know Winston Garland out there, Darius's dad. He coached, you know, local high school basketball there. But he also did something extraordinary, very interesting. He used to run a program, a recreation program in the Indiana State Prison, which is in Michigan City, Indiana, federal maximum security prison. And I went in there in my early 20s, a young journalist, and spent a day in the prison. Hanging out with Winston and talking to him and, you know, men in the prison who he worked with. Basically, they would have small college basketball teams come in and play the prison team that, you know, Winston oversaw. So we formed a bond through that experience. And all these years later in 2019, you know, I obviously been at the Beacon since 2010, had the Browns beat since then. 2019, the Cavs draft Winston's son, Darius, and I just thought it'd be awesome to one day be able to, you know, kind of reconnect with Winston and do a, you know, a story about how he's influenced his son, you know, as a basketball player, as a young man. And with Father's Day coming up, I said, wow, this could be a really fun story. And the planets or stars kind of aligned because they were having a youth basketball camp out in Northwest Indiana, where it all started for Winston, and certainly where he raised Darius until they moved to Tennessee after Darius finished sixth grade. So luckily, despite the prices of gas, which are, as we know, extraordinary right now, the bosses let me go out there and hang out with the Garlands for a day. And the Garlands let me go out there and gave me great access. And I interviewed Darius and Winston and Darius's mom and Winston's wife. In addition to Darius's, you know, longtime trainer who, you know, works with other NBA players as well. So it's like an amazing opportunity to interview all those people for like, you know, more than an hour and hang out with them and walk around and watch them interact with kids and each other for like 4 or 5 hours. It was a day, and I'm really thankful to be able to start the new gig that way. I thought it was awesome. So, like, you know, cheap plug here, but yeah, we say support local journalism, and I think this is a great example of, you know, why we believe that that's a worthy cause. I mean, obviously, it's our jobs, it's our livelihoods, but, you know, our company paid me to go out or paid the expenses to go out there and get some access that nobody else had. And I think it was, you know, a great opportunity. I'm glad we were able to do it. So if anybody's listening, and I really believe this is a good idea, if you don't have a Father's Day gift yet and you need something last minute, subscribe to the Beacon Journal and send your dad, you know, that subscription and email them a link to that story, because I really enjoyed doing it, and I hope some of our listeners enjoy reading it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful different look at a NBA star that you don't often get to see. And, you know, as expected, you hit the ground running with what your new role is. And, you know, at the end of the day, the job of a journalist is to deliver the news and tell stories. And now you're going to be in a position where, you know, now that you don't have to worry about the nuts and bolts of what's happening with the Cleveland Browns, you're going to get to focus on these tremendous stories. And, you know, everybody listening to this knows that Nate has a wonderful gift of storytelling. So he's going to get to do that on a more consistent basis. Look, from a personal level, Does it suck? Yeah, I think Nate has been the best person on the beat for a real long time. And yes, I'm of course biased in that probably, but I believe it's the case. Nobody works harder than he does. So difficult shoes to fill. I too am confident Chris Easterling will be able to fill your shoes on the Browns beat and do a great job. And the real cool thing is that, like Nate said, he's not going anywhere. So he's just doing something different. So it's going to be fun. All that goes to say, however, given that Nate is off the Browns beat, I also had a job change here with Gannett, the company that owns the Beacon Journal and all of our other sites. I have more of a managerial position now with the part of the work that I do. We are ending the podcast with Nate and I is the takeaway. And I think it's going to continue in the same space. I know we finally just got back on Apple Podcasts, so it should continue. I think the plan is for it to continue. It won't be Nate or I, so our mumbled Browns talk will be concluding on this podcast. But you know, I think we're going to be in good hands. So stay subscribed, all that kind of stuff. I'm pretty sure it's going to continue, just maybe with some different names. So with all that said, Nate, you want to talk about some of the memorable things that happened while you were on the Browns beat this whole time?
Couple things real quick though. First of all, I've told you, but I want to say it on the podcast, just a huge congratulations to you. Well deserved for you to get this promotion. Dan's not going to get into it much because, it's not his style, but he has been named the new manager for the Ohio Digital Optimization Team. What that means is he's in charge of, the USA to Network, all of Ohio. And, that's not just the Beacon Journal, but, Columbus Dispatch, Cincinnati Inquirer, some heavy hitters there. So you've done a great job, man. And honestly, like the stories that I'm trying to tell, like the people who do what Dan does and Dan leading everybody, like they help make sure that those stories get out there and they maximize our chances as writers to get those read and, to keep the company going. So it's a huge role. It's definitely something that I know you're going to do, great things with. I mean, you have all along. And so, as much as I'm excited to be doing something different, I'm excited that you're going to be, continuing to move up in the company. And it's really been an honor doing the podcast with you all these years. And yeah, it's going to continue. We're just kind of passing the torch and we will, both be involved just in a little bit different ways and, continuing to, on my end, find those awesome stories and try to do the best I can writing them and reporting on them and Dan trying to get eyes on them. So it goes hand in hand and I appreciate everything you've done. And, I can't think of a better person to be elevated into this position. I'm very fired up for you, man.
Well, thank you very much. It's very kind of you. Thanks, everybody, for listening to us pat ourselves on the back a little bit. I think after, like Nate said, we have no idea how long we've done this. We think we may have started in 2015 or 2014. No idea how many of these we've recorded. We're going to pat ourselves on the back a little bit here. I think that part of the podcast is over. So if you don't like gushy feeling stuff, I know I'm overcome with emotion right now. You can tell in my very animated voice, I'm sure. Thank you. Thanks everybody for listening. I know some of you have been very dedicated listeners, and we cannot thank you guys enough. Jim Baker is the one who sticks out to me, who has been probably our most ardent listener. And Jim, I know I do still owe you something for listening all the way through a podcast once, and I still owe you something. I will pay my debts, I can assure you. And Nate, I will pay my debts to you on Swenson's whenever we actually get the time to go. So, yeah, it's weird. We've recorded a lot of these, like a ton. Mm-hmm. And I know I was never the best at making sure they sounded the best, but hopefully the content was always enjoyable for everybody listening. And my goal on doing the podcast was always to kind of, number one, help deliver the Browns news to people in a way they want to get it delivered, but also to give people some insight onto, you know, the inside stuff, you know, like how Nate goes about his job and why the media works the way the media works. And I know that's not it doesn't sound the most fun, but I think we found a happy medium in how to do that over the years. And oftentimes that meant talking about very difficult things, mostly because the Browns were terrible. Like Nate mentioned before we recorded, they had the 1-31 string. Nate has covered 8 Browns coaches over the years, which is remarkable. So yeah, Nate, let's go over some of the more memorable things while you're on the beat for a little bit.
Okay.
Was there a game that really stuck out to you that, like, this is the most memorable game you've covered? I have one, if you want to think about that for a beat, that I'll talk about quickly.
Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, mine was week 3 of 2018, and that was the Baker Mayfield debut game on Thursday Night Football. So you had all of the glitz and glamour and Joe Buck and Troy Aikman, a national viewing audience, see the Browns come back and beat the Jets. Now, I know it's the Jets, and the Browns were not the best that year. They were starting to turn around that year, certainly. But that was a year after they went 0-16. So that to me was the most fun game, the most memorable game in the last 12 years or whatever. You know, Baker Mayfield running down the field, celebrating, the whole thing. That to me was the game that has been the most memorable during your coverage.
Yeah, that's definitely on the list. I've got a bunch. I don't know all the dates off the top of my head. I think it was 2010. Which would have been my first season on the beat. The Browns with Colt McCoy beat the Saints in New Orleans. I think David Bowens had like 2 interception returns for touchdowns, something really memorable like that. I mean, it was quite an upset. And you know, I mean, that was whatever. Eric Mangini, 4-5 win team. But just the kind of the shock of that game, you know, stands out. Josh Gordon, we were talking about Josh Gordon before we hit record because we were kind of figuring out when we might have started this thing based on Josh Gordon's suspensions, which his first full season he missed was 2015. right. So it's right around there. But Josh Gordon, the 2013. He played 14 games, but he had that 1,646 receiving yards, led the league. But he missed the first 2 games that year because of suspension. And that was what obviously the first in many suspensions for him. But what I remember is coming off that suspension, there was a ton of trade speculation because Joe Banner was the CEO at the time of the Browns. He was trying to trade Josh Gordon and got offers for him, and Jimmy Haslam vetoed the trade. Joe Banner will, he openly like discusses that now. But with all this trade stuff swirling and like national Sunday Splash reports coming out before that game, that Josh Gordon came back from that two-game suspension. It was in Minnesota. All this stuff swirling, and Josh Gordon just goes out there and just dominates. Just has it's just a crazy dominant performance coming off a suspension with all that stuff going on. Just speaks to the talent on the field that he was. I mean, just absolutely a tremendous football player. Obviously we go on and on and on, and we have through the years about. It's a shame that, you know, he wasn't able to fully capitalize on that. And, you know, other than that season in 2013, you know, we haven't seen it on a consistent basis. So that one sticks out. A couple of Brian Hoyer games stick out. There was the historic comeback in Tennessee. I forget exactly how many points the Browns were down. They came back from a lopsided margin and won. And then there was a Brian Hoyer game in Cincinnati. This was, 2015? Or 2014? It was the Mike Pettine year where they got off to a good start and they were leading. They were in the driver's seat. I think tied for first in the AFC North. They started 6-3, then went 7-4, and then fell apart at the end. But when I think it was when they improved to 6-3, they beat the Bengals in Cincinnati on national TV, you know, prime time. And the fans were chanting Brian Hoyer at Paul Brown Stadium. And I forget which analyst was it? The Deion Sanders?
That was 2014. The Browns won 24-3 in Cincinnati.
Yes. And then somebody afterward, they hit one of the networks had Brian Hoyer on for an interview, and they were saying, pay the man. You know, obviously it didn't happen with, you know, Johnny Manziel and the Browns turning to him and that blowing up in their face. Those are some of the games. And then more recently, in that 1-31 stretch, the one stands out sure. because they won on Christmas Eve to avoid in 20, that would have been 2015 to avoid 0-16. Of course they went 0-16 the next year or no, I'm sorry. That would have been 2016. 2016, Christmas Eve, 2016. They Jamie Meter blocks the field goal. And then, and then the Chargers in Cleveland miss a field goal that would I believe would have tied it and sent it overtime. So the Browns win their only game that season, their first victory under Hugh Jackson. And I remember Joe Thomas just being so emotional after that game because it was just so hard to go through as a player, and he was such a great player, gave it his all. They finally get the win. He's like, you know, tears of joy afterward. He comes to the podium. And I asked him about Jamie Meter blocking that one of the field goals, you know, the one that was a little earlier in the fourth quarter, not the final one, but the one that was, earlier in the fourth quarter. It was huge. It was a huge play. They needed that and the miss to win. And Joe Thomas then dubbed Jamie Meter the Pierogi Prince of Parma, which is just an all-time great quote nickname. I'll never forget that one. And then, you know, you were sitting right next to me, Dan. The Browns are beating the Steelers, which has been so rare in the expansion era. Prime time, Freddie Kitchens, the coach, 2019. And then the fight between Myles Garrett and Mason Rudolph breaks out, you know, at the very end of the game when, you know, and just what a wild night that was from a you know, reporter's perspective is, I mean, I did not sleep that night because I was rattled by the craziness, but because I was working and writing the entire night. Stayed up. It was one of the few all nighters I remember, and wrote the entire night, and then was awake in the morning when the NFL handed down the suspension, you know, on Myles Garrett for hitting Mason Rudolph over the head with the helmet. That I'll never forget. And then, you know, there's a bunch of other ones, but, you know, the playoff win in Pittsburgh, you know, I was there, and it was weird because I had not traveled. That was the COVID year, the first COVID season, and I had not traveled because, you know, the state of the pandemic made that very difficult, and, you know, we have company policies and all these things. So I was not flying like I had for almost every game. I you know, been lucky to travel to almost every Browns game except for that season. And because it was in Pittsburgh, I was able to make the quick drive over to Pittsburgh and cover the game like I did the other games in Cleveland that year. And for the Browns to win a playoff game when they, you know, hadn't done so since January 1st, 1995, and for them to be in the playoffs for the first time since the 2002 season, it was pretty cool to be there for that historic moment. But it was also surreal and weird and bizarre and odd because Heinz Field was virtually empty. I mean, because of the pandemic and the laws in Pennsylvania at the time with the COVID restrictions, it was limited to a family and friends crowd. So there was almost nobody there, which just added to how bizarre and weird the whole thing was, but, you know, also made it more memorable in a way. Not many people were there, so I was fortunate to be one of them to be able to chronicle that. And, you know, Juju Smith-Schuster gave the Browns that Browns is the Browns bulletin board material ahead of that game, and the Browns were not shy about, you know, throwing that in his face and then continuing to talk about it in the post game Zooms. There was no in-person news conference. So there was just so much packed into that. And I think that's a good place to end it.
Yeah, absolutely. I think those are some of the most memorable Browns situations over the last several years. You mentioned Joe Thomas, you mentioned Myles Garrett. The Browns have had plenty of notable quarterbacks and continue to do so, I suppose. But is there one player that the Browns have had over this period of time that you just really enjoyed covering?
Well, those guys are definitely on the list of favorite guys to cover just because you're talking about Joe Thomas, Myles Garrett being great players, but also being really interesting and also speaking their minds. And you can go to them and you know, talk to them about a variety of topics, and it's going to be an interesting conversation. And that's a writer's dream, you know. I mean, both those guys are quote machines, and, you know, you got the ultimate package there when you got a great player on the field who's, you know, interesting, you know, and gives great quotes and insight. You know, you can't ask for more than that. So those guys are definitely there. And then Joel Bitonio, you know, we as a media corps on the beat vote for a good guy award winner every year. And the good guy award goes to the player who's, you know, cooperative and accommodating to the media, helps us do our jobs. And the award is named after Dino Lucarelli, you know, who is a, you know, longtime, you know, Browns media liaison and really an advocate for the local beat before my time. So you can't rename the award, but if you could tack a name onto it, it could be Joel Bitonio. He could literally win the award every year. Now, I've been against that because I have wanted to spread the wealth a little bit and give other guys recognition. But Joel is just phenomenal to cover. Another great player who's always willing to help the media. He just gets it. You know, he gets it. We have jobs to do. And he's a helping hand that way. And I got to say that as great as a lot of guys have been to cover, nobody has actually thanked me for my coverage except for Joel Bitonio, which, I mean, it just, you know, it means a lot, you know. These are jobs, you know, they're really cool jobs. You get behind the scenes places a lot of fans would want to go. You know, so I do consider myself very lucky to have been able to do the job. But also, you know, there's a lot of hours that go into it. There's a lot of hard work that goes into it. There's a lot of sacrifices with, you know, family life and personal life and things like that. And I think Joel Bitonio gets that, you know, NFL coaches, NFL players work extremely hard. The hours are ridiculous for those people, especially the coaches. But I think he gets that the media that covers the NFL works really hard too. And, you know, don't make NFL coach or NFL player money. So Joel kind of sees the big picture and how it relates to real life in the real world. And he thanks, you know, people who work hard and try to cover the team well and, you know, tell the stories of the players. So I think that that says a lot about him and the kind of the perspective that he has. You know, speaks a lot to his character and his maturity and personality. So, you know, I just got to give him credit for being such a resource. Because honestly, in my, and I know this is from the reporter's view. When you are sharing your story as an NFL team, as an NFL coach, as an NFL player, when you're sharing it with the media, when you're open with the media, when you're helpful to the media, that benefits the fans. That, you know, that's letting the fans get to know you. And fans spend money to watch you as players, to watch you as coaches, to watch the product on the field, the product put together by the team. They buy jerseys, you know, so I think it is cool to let them in. And, you know, Joel has been the best at that. And there's some other guys who are have been really, really good, too.
Well said. Just from my perspective, you know, far on the outside, Joel Bitonio is an absolute favorite for all those reasons. And he's a hell of a player on top of all of it, too. We've talked about whether or not he's going to get some Hall of Fame consideration when his career concludes. And I think that the longer he plays, he's not getting worse. So, you know, down the line, there might be a story to write about Joel Bitonio getting the call from Canton. But, Nate, I have a couple more topics, and then we'll call it a day, because I know we're known for a very long podcast, so thanks everybody who listens to them. What is the most Brownsiest Browns moment that happened while you were on the beat? And by that, I mean, this is the team that did go 0-16, 1-31. Countless losing seasons, lots of weird stuff, suspensions, strange draft picks, instances around some of the draft picks, namely the Johnny Manziel one. There's been a lot of very Browns is Browns kind of things that have happened while you were on the beat. The one that sticks out for me is Freddie Kitchens wearing the Steelers shirt. In 2019, yeah, 2019.
Yeah,
the Browns were playing pretty well. They were feeling themselves. Freddie Kitchens shows up to some restaurant wearing a shirt that one of his kids made, I think, saying something about the Steelers. That to me was the what the hell is going on around here, or what the hell? What's the Vince Lombardi line? What the hell's going on around here? Yeah. That to me was the most Brownsiest Browns thing that happened while you were on the beat.
Yeah, yeah. The his daughters bought him the shirt.
Yes.
The Steelers started it in reference to the Myles Garrett Mason Rudolph fight.
Yes, thank you.
Yes, and that is Yeah, that's hard to top. I don't think I can top that one. You know, certainly there are things during the Hugh Jackson years. I mean, just the whole rise of Freddie to begin with and how it was kind of foreshadowed on Hard Knocks with him speaking up in a meeting with, you know, Hugh Jackson running the meeting, Freddie Kitchens speaking up and saying that, like, you know, he didn't necessarily agree with kind of Hugh Jackson's plan for letting players rest during practices. Todd Haley siding with Freddie in that meeting. Hugh saying that he drives the bus. You know what I mean? That moment right there, you know, Hard Knocks sweeping in. Then Freddie talks to the media after that. He's a running backs coach at the time. Downplays the entire thing. Says that stuff happens all the time in meetings. And to some extent, I'm sure it probably does. But the way it played out after that, with Hugh and Todd fighting, all the dysfunction, them being fired on the same day in that 2018 season. And then, you know, Freddie Kitchens becoming the, you know, offensive coordinator and Greg Williams, the interim head coach, and the Browns going on a little bit of a hot streak there at the end to go 5-3 in the last 8 games. And then Freddie get the head coaching job. I mean, just that. And then for him to flame out and just be the one and done head coach with Odell Beckham Jr. coming to town and all that stuff. That right there, the whole Freddie rise and fall is like, that's a few books right there. I mean, that's kind of the whole thing. And certainly Steelers started it, or Pittsburgh started it, is kind of the, you know, climax there. It's a spectacular Browns is Browns stretch right there. You know, the one thing with, I'll say this is, this is kind of captures the craziness and the wild nature of the expansion era for the most part. Johnny Manziel is known for a lot of things, and a lot of people who talk about Johnny Manziel always point to the basically that he went AWOL from the team, you know, while he was in concussion protocol and dressed up in a disguise and went around Las Vegas, the club scene, and was calling himself Billy Manziel and wearing a fake mustache and wig and glasses and all that stuff. That's a movie right there. I mean, it's going to be in the 30 for 30 ratings are going to be off the charts. They talk about the swan, you know, the photo with the swan, whatever bottle he had on the swan in the pool. They talk about the money phone video. And the money phone video was crazy because he was basically supposed to be on his best behavior at that time. Like Mike Pettine had kind of laid the law down, like, hey, you know, Pettine wasn't as serious early on. Like, it was like, okay, like, guys are going to blow off steam. Guys are going to party. Guys are going to let loose. And then it got so out of control that Pettine, like, really kind of, like, tried to put the toothpaste back in the tube there with Johnny and say, like, no, like, this is out of hand. You can't, you know, we can't have you going out and doing this stuff. And then after that whole, you know, and Pettine was a quote machine in his own right, probably the most, you know, forthcoming coach that I covered. And he, you know, basically made this known that these were the expectations for Johnny. And then the money phone video came out, and like the day it came out, or I think it was the day it came out, the Browns were doing stuff at the Cleveland Food Bank. I think it was around Thanksgiving. They typically have players go and, you know, help with packaging up, you know, goods for, you know, distribution around Thanksgiving. And Johnny Manziel was there, and I remember asking him, like, you know, because we don't, you know, the video, it's one of those things. The video comes out, it looks crazy, you know, he can barely open his eyes, he's yelling into a stack of money, like he's talking on the phone. And, you know, but when was that video shot, right? I mean, it's the traps of, and the pitfalls of covering, you know, stories that are generated on social media and go viral. And so, you know, I was trying to ask Johnny Manziel when he did the Cleveland Food Bay, we talked about the event, and then, hey, you know, with this video coming out, you know, was that recent or is that an old video? And he said he did not know. And I said, hey, you know, I'm just trying to be fair to you here, giving you a chance to explain it. And he says, I really don't know. So I don't know if he remembered that video being made or if he was just saying he didn't know because he didn't want to admit that he had done that the previous weekend or, you know, a day or two ago. I still don't know to that day, but that was wild. And everybody points to those episodes in the Manziel thing. But the Manziel episode that people forget about, which is the ultimate kind of crazy dysfunction, wild scene. And it was, there's some seriousness to it, so I don't want to, you know, laugh about it, but it's just a crazy, the idea of this happening to an NFL quarterback is crazy. You know, I forget all the details, so I don't want to, I just know there's a dispute between him and his girlfriend, and he left wherever they were together, an apartment or hotel. I forget again all the details, but when he left, I believe that I think it was his ex-girlfriend at the time, that she had made a call to the police. Okay. The police took out a helicopter and were flying around Texas, wherever they were. Maybe it was Fort Worth area. They were looking for Johnny Manziel with a police chopper. To me, that's the craziest Manziel story of all. I think that tops all. I think of the scene in Goodfellas where he's, well, seriously, where he's driving and he's looking and the helicopter's flying overhead. Like that was a Johnny Manziel moment where he's running around, on foot for part of it. And they are searching for him with a police chopper. Like that, nobody talks about that. Like that part has gotten lost in the shuffle because there's not like a video or a photo of it. You know, he hasn't talked about that in podcasts like he has with the Billy Manziel stuff, but there's a police report about it. And the police were open about, yeah, we broke out the chopper searching for him. And he was a Browns quarter. He was on the roster at the time. So like, to me, that is the ultimate moment.
Man, what I had to mute myself during a lot of that, what you were just saying, because I was laughing so hard.
Because it's just mind-boggling that actually.
Yeah.
Happened. Yeah.
It's such a saga. Like, I don't want to be one of those old people who says things like, imagine if that happened now. But imagine if an NFL quarterback is getting, you know, a police helicopter after him in today's day and age. Absolutely wild stuff. Nate, I cannot let you go off the podcast without one final round of predictions. Yes, it's still spring. Yes, mini camp just ended. By the way, there's full coverage of mini camp over at beaconjournal.com/sports/Browns. Thank you. But I do want to get you on the record. What will be the Browns record for 2022?
Without knowing.
Yes.
What's going to happen with Deshaun Watson? How many games he'll miss if he misses the season or part of it?
Do you want to make that a prediction too? How long do you think Deshaun Watson's going to be suspended?
Oh, geez. Well, I'll give you. I'll say this: if he doesn't play, I'll give a couple sets of predictions then. So let's just say he doesn't. If he doesn't play in 2022, which would, you know. Just to backtrack, because we've talked about this many times, and I came out of the owners' meetings in late March. The vibe from kind of the Browns and the league and the, you know, 6 to 8 games seemed like what people were thinking. I mean, that wasn't, you know, a specific number. You can't nail it down. Nobody knows, but it just, you know, there was a feeling that, you know, yes, he's going to get suspended, but, you know, it's not going to, you know, be a throw the book at you type situation necessarily. You know, I chronicled in the podcast with Brent Schrodenboer from USA Today that we did about all the Deshaun Watson situation and all the legal stuff. you know, the Jimmy Haslam said that he thought when the legal process played out, Deshaun would be in a good spot and the Browns would be in a good spot and that the league would agree with that, that everybody's in a good spot. So there's some optimism there. Since then, more lawsuits have been filed. Tony Busby, the attorney for the plaintiffs, has said on the record to multiple media outlets, including Chris Easterling, that more lawsuits are on the way. So, you know, we're up to 24 that have been filed now, and it was 22 when the Browns made the trade. It was 22 during those owners meetings when there was some optimism kind of surrounding the situation. You know, there's been, an HBO Real Sports episode with two of the accusers speaking publicly on camera, since, the owners meetings and this is just mounting. Things are continuing to roll here. New York Times with a story coming out that said not that Deshaun Watson used 66 massage therapists, since whatever the span was, 2019, but that he used at least 66. That the New York Times in its reporting put the number at least 66. All this has come out, right? So there's now a feeling that this suspension could be, more severe than maybe the parties involved thought in late March. So if he doesn't play in 2022, I think the Browns will win 7 games. I think it's that big a difference. If he plays a whole season, which, I don't expect to happen, I think that they are, a 10-11 win team, even with, him shaking off Russ potentially for missing a season. I think that the talent is just so good across the board. I think this defense is really going to take a next step with not only the talent there again, but also some continuity. Remember how many of these guys were new last year, like Denzel Ward and Myles Garrett were like the only, full-time starters back. Now a lot of the personnel's back, the Browns have their coordinators back, now Kevin Stefanski's still going to call the offensive plays, but they have 3 coordinators back, for a third consecutive season, unprecedented in an expansion era. So, I think that they, if Deshaun Watson didn't have a suspension to deal with, that they would win, even with a tough schedule and a stacked AFC, I think they would win 11 games. So I said 10-11. I'm going to go 11. I think if he's suspended for the year, I think that's the difference. I think they go from an 11-win team to a 7-win team if you're turning to, Jacoby Brissett as your starter there. Now, if he's suspended for part of the season, I think it falls in between there, say he does miss, 6 to 8 games, you're probably looking at, 9 wins. These are the kind of predictions I would make. And I'm sorry, but you're not going to, if he misses 6 to 8 games with the AFC as talented as it is with the quarterbacks in it, and I think it's going to be such a tight race to get in the playoffs that I don't think they're going to make the playoffs. So I think for Browns fans who want to see this team back in the playoffs, I would not expect it in 2022 because I think Deshaun Watson will be suspended for at least part of the season, and therefore it's just going to be too steep a hill to climb, to get in the postseason with his. I think that the conference is just going to be so tough and so good, I think the margin for error is going to be very slim.
Yeah, I think that is spot on. I think the margin for error in the AFC, no matter whether or not Deshaun plays, is razor thin.
Yeah.
My prediction would be if he doesn't play at all, that as these things just continue to mount and the narrative for the NFL gets worse, and that's really what the NFL cares about, how it makes the NFL look. I really have to wonder if he's going to get a full year suspension at this point. And if he does, I think the Browns are a 6-win team. I think they become extremely one-dimensional on offense. And that is that they become such a run-heavy team that opponents can just figure out how to stop that. And it'll be hard to come back in games if they get behind, if you're relying on the backup quarterbacks. So no Deshaun, I'm going to say 6. I think if he happens to play a full season, which I highly doubt, I would say 12. And if he gets that 6 or 8 game suspension, which, you know, some people seem to believe, I would go 9 as well. So 6, 9, 12, depending on suspension length, which is
right.
What a situation the Browns find themselves in. You know, I think we've said it before. If this thing with Deshaun Watson completely blows up, what a monumental error by the Cleveland Browns. No draft picks, no money, no quarterback. And that's not the way to run an NFL franchise, is all. So, Browns. Oh, Browns.
Yeah, Nate? We're right there in the same kind of ballpark with me going, 7, 9, and 11. So,
yep.
That's what we basically refused to play the schedule game when the schedule came out. Like we normally give a record prediction then, but until we know, and that's the thing, like until we know the number of games Deshaun Watson's going to miss, everything is up in the air. This is just a very, very talented roster, but that position, I mean, it's everything. So, I mean, think about the receiving core, right? Amari Cooper, 4-time Pro Bowler. And then the rest is, you know, guys who were, you know, unproven at the NFL level over like a consistent long stretch. So if you have Donovan Peoples-Jones as your number 2, you have David Bell as a rookie in the slot. You know, I think the Browns think, well, we're going to be okay because, you know, if Deshaun Watson's the quarterback anyhow, he's going to make the receivers, the pass catchers better. You know, he's going to elevate them. But if he's not, it's Jacoby Brissett. You know what I mean? There's just such a monumental domino effect there. If you're dropping from an elite talent at quarterback to a guy who's, you know, been a career number 2, but does have a decent amount of starting experience, you know, under his belt and has been the guy at times in his career. So not to take everything away from Jacoby Brissett, but you don't want him, you know, your starter for the full season. The Browns could be in that position. So I'm with you, Dan. I think we're right kind of in lockstep there with very similar predictions.
Indeed we are. Anything else before we check out one last time?
One last thing. You know, I do want to say that, you know, thank you for everything and, you know, the kind words you said earlier about me, my run on the Browns beat, very meaningful to me. But I think something that a lot of people probably don't realize is how close and tight knit the Browns beat is. Like I've got so many friends on the Browns beat who work for other news outlets, obviously, but we are really tight and I consider them, you know, some of my best friends and there's just so many really good people on that beat who do so much good work. And if you go on Twitter, you probably won't hear that. You probably won't read that. You know, if you listen to sports talk radio in Cleveland, you know, they get trashed a lot by the radio hosts. The beat as a group, you know, does get dunked on a lot on Twitter and things like that. Man, you know, I just think it's easy, you know, to kind of take those shots on the outside. But I think there are so many talented and great people working the Browns beat. You know, Scott Petrek is a really good friend. Mary Kay Cabot is a really good friend. Tom Withers is a really good friend. You know, I've got, you know, just people who had been supporting me, obviously with the Beacon Journal, great coworkers, and you're one of them, Dan. But I've also had the support of people on the beat more experienced than me who've been doing it for even a longer time, in some cases a much longer time than 12 seasons. And, you know, it just does kind of have a great camaraderie to it. I don't think a lot of people know that. Like, you know, when we go out to on the road, we're eating dinners together, you know, obviously pre-pandemic. Things haven't been the same since then. But, you know, I hope to get back to it. And, you know, we do stuff with each other's families and things like that. And that's you know, something that I'll definitely miss. But I'll still be around, so I'll still get to see you know, some of those people who I've grown really close to. But yeah, there really is a great camaraderie. I mean, Dan Lobby and Zach Jackson, I've known for years. There's some really good people in there, some hilarious people, very hardworking, very smart. So I just want to, because the Browns beat gets bashed so much, I just want to kind of let everybody know that, you know, I know what goes into it, and I can tell you that those people are really dedicated and doing great work, and they are, you know, very committed to covering the team, you know, and telling the stories. I'm certainly not the only one, and I thank them for, you know, just friendship and, you know, support and camaraderie. I didn't want that to go unsaid, because there's a huge element of that behind the scenes that I don't think most people are aware of.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough. You let me into the press box for the 2019 season. It was something I'll never, ever forget for the rest of my career. Easily a highlight and a big thing for me. So thank you for doing that. And the one person whose name does need to be mentioned is our colleague, Marla Ridenour. Man, she's the best, just the best. Nate, I know you think very highly of Marla. George Thomas, our coworker, is great. Steve Dorshuk is great. We have some great folks. Marla, especially, the best, absolute best. So,
yeah, no doubt. You know, being able to do the beat with her helping me transition into it more than a decade ago, and you know, being able to help me throughout the entire time has been an honor. She is truly a Hall of Famer, and she's actually in Kentucky and Ohio Journalism Hall of Fames now. So, like, right. That's not like a figurative statement. Yeah. So she is definitely, when I'm talking about coworkers, and she knows how much she means to me. And there's so many others, editors. So yeah, thanks for everybody. Thanks you guys for listening. It's been an honor to do this beat and to have you guys listening, to have you guys reading, to have all the support from people who I work with, people who, you know, work for the other, you know, media outlets. It's been a great ride, and looking forward to continuing, but doing some different stuff, branching out and really kind of finding out how good of a storyteller I can really be.
Yeah, it's going to be great. So that is going to do it for Cover 2 for Nate and I. Make sure you're following Nate on Twitter. He's at by Nate Ulrich. You probably know that by now. Make sure you're following Chris on Twitter. He's C Easterling ABJ. He's going to do a great job on the beat, and we'll see what happens with the podcast. You know, there's some discussions on who might be doing it. Whoever it is, they're going to do great. Neither Nate nor I will be that far away anyway. You know, you can get at us on Twitter all you want or wherever, and make sure you are reading Nate's stuff, because it's really wonderful. And please do, if you do not, consider supporting local journalism. If you're listening to this immediately after I post it and you're not a subscriber, we have a deal coming up. It's $2, I think, $22 for 2 years. Yeah. that launches the week of the 20th. So please do consider subscribing to your local newspaper. Please do consider giving us a nice rating on Apple for one last time. Thank you very much for listening. You know what? We will not talk to you next time.